We're delighted to welcome here this morning high school students from two high schools. One, Brown Deer High School. Would those students please stand? Please be seated. And Menominee Falls High School. Please stand. May be seated. The students are here with us with a program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. The program is called Court with Class. Students from high schools around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, then they are sent briefs of the case that they're about to hear, and may do a variety of work on this case. In addition to that, the students will meet with a justice after our second case today, which will be approximately noon. And the justice varies from session to session. Today, that justice will be Justice Crooks. We've met you, and let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, who is being spoken to by the marshal. I don't think he did anything wrong.
I just asked for my pencil.
Okay.
The erasers.
Thank you, Marshal. And to the immediate right is Justice Patrick Crooks, with whom you'll meet at noon. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rovensack. With those introductions made, we'll call our first case for today, 03-0862, Raul J. Walters v. National Properties, LLC. Arguing on behalf of National Properties is Attorney Thomas B. Burke. Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am Thomas Burke. I represent the appellant, National Properties. National Properties is also the tenant under a lease with the respondent, Raul Walters. The lease runs for a possible term of 30 years. It's a commercial lease. This case arises from defaults by the tenant. It's before this court this morning because of a disputed notice sent by the landlord to the tenant that referenced those defaults. It is disputed, perhaps because of the choice of only one word by the landlord, and perhaps one phrase that was not contained in the lease, not contained anywhere in the lease, but was contained in the notice. The trial court, and again, the Court of Appeals held, and if I may quote the Court of Appeals, we agree with the trial court that the lease agreement controls the termination and eviction procedure rather than the default notice. Appellant respectfully contends this is not only incorrect law, but is bad public policy. Landlord-tenant cases tend to be, as I'm sure you are all aware, as the court is aware, tend to be quite fact-intensive.
If I can just interrupt you a minute, you have interpreted the word service in the notice as receipt, correct?
That is correct, Your
Honor. Why don't you interpret service as mailing?
Because if you look at the notice, Your Honor, because service is, well, the obvious answer is the word service is not the word mail.
How about 801.15? Seems to me that talks about service by mail.
Yes, but I think in this case, because it is a commercial lease, and under, I think it's 704.17, the terms of that lease can be, or the terms of that statute can be varied by the lease, we have to look at the lease. And so as a result, the service is not, it's not, the first place to look in a commercial lease setting is the lease, for that reason. And then you would look to the statute perhaps later on if it becomes.
So you're telling me that you're not interpreting service as mailing, but rather as receipt because the lease defines service as receipt?
No, the lease is silent on that point completely.
Right,
the term service is not in the lease, Your Honor.
It's not in the lease. It's just in the notice. So I ask you my question again. Why are you interpreting that as receipt rather than mailing?
It's totally within the control of the landlord, the person sending a lease, sending a notice, I should say, to write that notice. Contract is a conveyance. A lease is a conveyance. It's also a contract. And notices are written every day by all kinds of people, both lawyers and non-lawyers. And they have, in the first instance, the ability to define to write the notice and define the terms in the notice if that's what they wish to do. So for that reason, since it is not defined in the lease, it permits, the law seems to be clear that if it's not defined as mailing, its service happens upon receipt. And that is the contention of the appellant in this case, Your Honor.
But again, counsel, maybe I'm confused because to follow up on Justice Rogenstein's question, what difference would it make in this case? If you look at 801.15 sub 5A, if the notice or paper served by mail, 3 days shall be added to the prescribed period. So instead of 30 days under the lease, it's 33 days. It comes to the same date, doesn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then what's the difference?
In that circumstance, if it's treated as if the service of this notice would be treated as the service of a summons or another pleading in a case of motion, that type of thing, you would simply add 3 days.
Seems
as you would run.
But what your problem here, and I think that's why you're giving the answers to my colleagues, is basically, as you said, because this is a lease of more than 1 year, you fall under the statute that you indicated, 704.17, and defined in the lease now is that mailing and default, you have the term default there, you have the term mailing. What you're saying, because they did not have this one word, which is service, therefore that's ambiguous. In other words, the mailing would not apply in this case because of the inclusion of that one word. That's what you're saying.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm saying if the word mailing was just changed to the date of the notice, if, in other words, that word had been written as notice, then under the terms of the lease, it's 30 days from the date of the notice.
Okay.
And that would be that would change quite dramatically, perhaps, the result in this case.
Mr. Burke, let me ask you about some other matters. Let's assume for a minute that your clients paid the rent in the time period allowed. There are four items that are set forth in the notice. Did they meet all of those items? Did they provide the receipts and provide the information regarding the annual sales and pay the property taxes also within the time period?
The short answer to your question, Mr. Justice Crooks, is no, they didn't do that. However, there's two answers to that. There's two things that the court has to look at in this particular case. Number one, the notice itself, again, which is totally within control of the, in this case, the landlord who's giving the notice. He talks about curing defaults, but then he said only full payment of the rent demanded in this notice will waive landlord's right to terminate possession under this notice. And I might note, Your Honor, that often in commercial leases, property taxes are defined as additional rent. They aren't in this lease for whatever reason. However, whoever wrote this lease did not define them as additional rent. And under...
Well, let me ask you about the two clauses you're talking about right now. The one just before the one you just mentioned, talks about the fact that unless such defaults are resolved on or before the dates at issue, 30 days, the landlord will be able to proceed to do, among other things, termination of your possession of the premises. Isn't that pretty clear?
Yes, Your Honor, but that paragraph states the general. And the typical rule of construction is that the particular controls the general. The next paragraph goes on to state, only full payment of the rent demanded in this notice will waive the landlord's right to terminate. So it's appellant's contention, Your Honor, that because of the language that was chosen by the landlord in this case, saying the rent will, full payment of the rent terminates or satisfies the notice, that that controls the general statement. In addition, in 8704.17.3, which talks about leases for more than 1 year, and it talks about notices, it says a tenant is deemed to be complying with the notice if steps to remedy the if he takes steps to remedy the default and proceeds with reasonable diligence. Now, because these procedures are summary procedures, in fact, I believe from the record, it indicates that this entire trial took about an hour, which is about the same time that this case is scheduled for argument this morning. These things are gone into extremely quickly. Now, there's nothing in the record to indicate that there wasn't reasonable diligence to comply with those other terms. And so as a result of the notice talking about making the focus on the rent and the statute indicating that the other defaults, other than non-rent defaults, and again, property taxes I do not believe are defined as additional rent, the fact that they ultimately cured those things or attempted to cure those things, we really don't know at this point from the record what, if anything, was done. So the assumption can't be made that they didn't do those
things. Well, didn't the receipts and the sales information, didn't that trigger a requirement of additional payments depending on how much was at issue?
It did, Your Honor. And again, this goes to the question of long-term leases versus leases for a year, apartment-type leases for a year. Generally speaking, when people get involved in long-term leases or long-term agreements really of any sort, practices tend to creep up that are somewhat at variance with the terms of the contract. Here, apparently, there was suggestion in the record that neither my client nor the previous tenant who assigned its rights to my client ever sent in such sales reports. And apparently the reason they never did that is because no money was ever owed under that clause. What's interesting, of course, is that there is in this a typical provision, Section 19, which talks about waivers. And it said just because, which remedies the situation of different types of conduct between the parties that grow up over time. It says, okay, if we've done this for 5 or 6 years, and we haven't been that precise in requiring reports or whatever it is, we can then say, okay, now you have to do it. Now you have to do those things. And they certainly are within their rights to do that. But when they do it in a notice, it's also controlled by the section, the provision that talks about defaults for non-payment of rent, which these clearly are. For non-payment of rent, it's just additional percentage monies that would be due. And as a result of that, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record which would indicate that they didn't make some reasonable effort to do that. In fact, there's a suggestion that they were eventually supplied at a later date.
Now, so their brief on pages 19 and 20 are inaccurate, that they were supplied that? Because we're talking about here, if I understand the provision, paragraph 18, that if the lessee should be in fault of any covenant agreement or condition, then upon occurrence of any one or more, they should be given notice by certified mail of such default. They have 30 days after the date, and they come to, at least what I read here is that the matters that Justice Crooks is talking about, they never provided Walters with its monthly sales information. So it was never provided. I assume the record, that's, and they refer to record 28-18. That's all I was.
I would say this, Your Honor. The answer, again, has to do with the provision of the statute, which refers to non-monetary defaults, and also the provision of the lease, which the particular provision deals with the monetary default, which, understandably, a landlord would be most concerned about. And the fact that he hadn't done it all those years probably indicates that he knew that the percentage lease was likely not to be triggered.
Now, who would know that, the landlord or the lessee?
In footnote 2, I presume both would. Well, I presume the lessee, of course, would know that. What is noted on page 19 in the footnote is by the landlord is the fact that belated annual sales figures ultimately supplied by the tenant did not indicate that it owed further rental Walters as immaterial. They call that immaterial. And they said, of course, there's a specific obligation to provide such information, and it breached that obligation by refusing to produce its annual sales information within 30 days of the notice and refusing to ever produce its monthly totals. But apparently they never complained about that again on the basis of the annual reports, which would have taken them through 2002 from what appears to be in the record. The appellant believes that there's a simple test to determine, to evaluate a notice when it's presented to a court, or for that matter, it's presented to a person who receives a notice. The first is to read the notice and ask, of course, is it properly served? That's going to be the issue, whether it's properly served under the contract or a statutory notice of any type. Then the second question that should be asked is, does it comply with the statute under which it's given, or in this case, the contract or the lease under which it's given? Then the question, of course, is, among others, does it allow at least the minimum time?
Counsel, I don't hear the difference between your first two questions.
Well, does it comply, Your Honor? First of all, you read the notice and does it comply with the statute or the lease? You have to see what the notice is that you're giving, under what provisions you're giving it under. It could be in a landlord-tenant context or any other context. And there may be contractual requirements for such a notice as there are in the case of bar, or there may be statutory requirements for notice. And the first question was it properly served? Because obviously if any notice is not properly served, it's probably deemed ineffective.
How do we know if it's properly served?
Well, that would be done at some subsequent hearing on the issue. That would be for the trier of fact to ultimately determine. Certainly, Your Honor, in the situation where someone receives a notice, brings it into a lawyer's office, that's typically the first question that's asked. How was it served? And there's a check to see if it was properly served. And then you go on to actually read the notice and ask whether it complies with the statute under which it's served or the lease. Then the next question would be, does it allow at least the minimum time periods to cure this notice of default, to cure the default, or to exercise whatever right or remedy that it purports to invoke? And if the answer to that is yes, let's say the answer to that is no. If the answer to that is no, then obviously, again, the lease is defective. If the answer to that is yes, that it provides at least the minimum requirements of the statute or the contract or the lease, then the next question is, did the person receiving the notice properly comply with the notice? The argument here is that the notice on its face seemed to provide more time than the lease provided. In other words, if you don't look at Chapter 801.15 and you just simply look at...
Let me just go back to 801.15 just so we don't get into a hassle about that. As I read 801.15, it only governs court proceedings. It doesn't attempt to govern other notices that are outside of a court proceeding. And this is not a notice inside a court proceeding.
That is correct, Your Honor. I have not argued that point. It was in response to a question.
I understand
that. By analogy, how notices are normally.
But it would have to be analogy because it does not cover this case under the words of the scope of the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the appellant has not argued that 801.15 controls.
I understand that.
The issue in this case is whether, and this gets to the nub of the issue, which controls, or how do you read these together to harmonize them?
You're now talking about the lease and the notice.
We're talking about the notice and then the lease.
Okay. The notice says what?
The notice says...
What are the exact words in
the issue? The exact words of the notice are... You are further notified that unless such defaults are resolved on or before the expiration of 30 days after service of this notice, landlord will exercise its remedies under the lease.
And what's the lease term?
The lease term, which is paragraph 18 of the lease, there's actually two paragraphs that are subtly inconsistent.
With each other.
With each other.
And then with the notice.
And then with the notice.
Okay, what's the second lease term?
18 says, lessee has 30 days after the date of such notice to correct such default or defaults.
Now that's so the date of notice.
References okay. The date of the notice. Paragraph 22, reference says, the time of any such notice shall begin to run with the date of the mailing of such notice. Now, in this case, Your Honor, the record indicates that those dates were the same. And what I believe the record also implies is that when people draft leases or other kinds of legal documents and you go through them, sometimes with a fine-tooth comb, it's amazing how sometimes these inconsistencies crop up that you didn't see when you first drafted them. And they're very subtle. And in this case,
we have the same problem with writing opinions.
As a result, that's one of the reasons, I suppose, that a certain amount of wiggle room is, if you wish to call it that, wiggle room is put in some of these, is interpreted to be present in some of these provisions. Because when you read them all together and you really scrutinize them, which obviously is often very difficult for a court commissioner or a trial judge to do in a very brief period of time to kind of capture this whole thing that people have spent hours now analyzing, they have to kind of try to get it right the first time, and sometimes that's very difficult where these subtle differences apply. So the rule that you look to the notice, and that the rule that...
Where do you get that rule?
The rule of construction, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you look to the case that really is sort of the opposite in some respects of the case that is being argued today, this case that's being argued today, a case that was argued before this court 60 years ago, which is the Hotel Hay case. In that case, this court looked to the notice and said, and then looked to the lease and said, you have 20 days to correct the default. The landlord in that particular case said, well, that's from the date of mailing. And the court in that case said, no, since the lease doesn't define that, doesn't say that it's 20 days from the mailing, you have 20 days from the receipt. And so when a subsequent statutory notice was a 3-day notice, which apparently was required in that day, was given, the court ruled that notice was given too early and the eviction action that was attempted to be commenced upon that notice was also found to be prematurely served. This case involves the opposite. This case involves the landlord, according to the landlord's own brief, giving the tenant, in effect, too much time, or potentially giving the tenant too much time to comply. And they're saying, don't pay attention to what we have in our notice, let's go right to the lease. Which is, in my experience, and I think the real-world experience, not the way these things typically happen. People tend to get notices, they tend to comply with those notices, if they can comply with those notices, and it seems that the question that finally should be asked is, did the party who gave the notice received what he asked for? And we would submit, Your Honor, the appellant would submit that, in effect, they did receive what they asked for. They received payment. Now, on that issue of payment, there's the question of, okay, does mailing equal payment? Well, again, apparently these parties are, the landlord is out of state. There's an indication that payment.
Counsel, before you get to payment, can we just, I just want, when you respond to the opposing counsel's argument, they say that you're ignoring the fact that service means mailing. And in the lease, they talk about service, and I'm talking about strike that. In their brief, they talk about service. Service and mailing are one and the same. What's your response to that? What is, you're saying that they, your argument is that they waived it, but what is your response to that in the lease, the understanding is service and mailing are synonymous. They're the same.
My response to that is simply they could have very easily said in the, they could have chosen a different word. They're the ones that use the word service. They introduced that word for the first time. Service, it's common sense meaning, it's plain meaning, a service is receipt. Now, it's true, they could have invoked their right, as the appellant concedes, that they could have said, you have 30 days from the date of this notice, or perhaps 30 days from the mailing of this notice. And the presumption, I suppose, is that if the mailing took place a day later or over a weekend, that type of thing, the notice was was drafted on a Friday and was mailed by some secretary on a Monday morning, that the tenant would get those extra 3 days right then and there. But we don't really, that's just all speculation. We know what was written in the lease. We know there's a subtle inconsistency in the lease. And we know that the notice itself, which is totally in control of the landlord, says 30 days from the service. And really, there is no authority for the proposition that in a case like such as this, that service and mailing are synonymous. The authority goes just in the opposite direction, which is that service equals receipt, where the lease doesn't expressly make it so. And if they had defined service in that way in the lease, again, that lease was undoubtedly drafted by the landlord. They could have defined service in the lease to equal mailing, but that was not done.
Yeah, well, their argument is that you haven't cited, and see, they haven't cited, but you haven't cited any cases in which a court would hold that the language of the 30-day abrogates the express language in the lease.
I guess that gets down to two questions. Number one, that apparently this court has never exactly decided that issue before. And then the other issue is that it seems obvious that that would be the case. And perhaps that's the reason there's a dearth of appellate authority on that particular point.
Well, Judge Snyder, in his appellate decision, and you cited the Hay Hotel case, says that in that example, or this, that the lease controls, that's what he said is just opposite of, although you use the case, he cites it in his decision to this court, upholding that the lease would control. And that's what he says that the hotel case stands for.
The standard I'm urging this court to adopt is that you first look at the notice. And the reason for that is this is what people respond to. If you ignore the notice, in effect, and you go directly to the lease, what you're doing is you're inviting a person giving a notice, here the landlord, to kind of game the system. The tenant here could come in and say, you know, I've complied with this notice in every way. And yet the landlord could say, it's too late. Because under the landlord's theory of this case, even had the rent been paid, physically received in cash or otherwise, by the landlord on the date on which it was mailed, the landlord is arguing here that that is already too late. And you could not ascertain that from the reading, the plain reading of the notice. You would have thought you would have been on time. And as a result, the idea should, it seems to the appellant, the idea should be to get people, to encourage people to be more precise in their language so that a person receiving a notice knows exactly what it is they should be responding to.
Now, I just want to follow up one
ahead. Justice Wilk.
The issue here, 30 days is in the lease, and what if they had said 60 days?
Your Honor, I think that they could have said 60 days, and I think that this often happens. And, in fact, they allude to it in their own notice. In their own notice, and the reason that that often happens is when you deal with tenants, sometimes they'll say to you, look, we know, Mr. Landlord, that we owe you $5,000 and we're in default. But we can't pay the $5,000 now. We'll pay you $2,500 now. We'll pay you $2,500 2 months from now. And even in the notice itself, it says that only full payment of the rent demanded will waive the landlord's right to terminate unless the landlord agrees in writing to continue possession in exchange for receiving partial payments, which is a typical practice under all kinds of agreements, including long-term leases. So had they said that, I don't think there would be a problem for the landlord to give more time.
How about less time?
The landlord cannot give less time.
Why? Because the lease controls?
Because the lease controls that.
So the lease only controls if the landlord harms the tenant, but doesn't control if the landlord gives extra benefits to the tenant. So the landlord unilaterally can change the lease. That's your position. If it helps you.
Well, unlike many laws and many rules and many schemes of regulation, a lease is a document that sets minimum requirements for people with which to comply. And this lease says 30 days is the minimum, just like all kinds of rules, all kinds of laws that we have. And certainly minor waivers of those law, of those whatever the rights are routinely done every single day by all kinds of people in all kinds of different contexts, whether it's landlord-tenant or all kinds of other contexts. So that, yes, I believe they could have given more time because the presumption is they want to get their rent. That's what they're doing. And if they give more time, they have a right to do that.
How many years left on the lease?
This point, Your Honor, the lease started in 1993, and it was renewed in 2003 for a second 10 years. There is the potential for a third 10-year lease, but it talks about rent to be negotiated at the time that the third 10-year term would commence. So there is a question, quite obviously, as to whether or not it's an essential term of the lease has been negotiated in view of the fact, or is present in view of, unless other than it says that it has to be at least a minimum amount.
Is a favorable lease to the tenant?
The way I read this lease, it's probably a common landlord lease.
But I mean the dollar amount for the rent.
The dollar amount, yes. Is a favorable lease? No, it seems to be a fair lease because there was an escalator that's about 2.5%. Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll now hear from Martin B. Carroll for Paul J. Walters, and Mr. Carroll will be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Joseph M. Caramone III.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Joseph Cardamone. I am pleased this morning to present my co-counsel on behalf of Raul Walters, the plaintiff respondent, Martin B. Carroll of the State of Illinois, who was admitted pro hoc vice in the trial court and will be presenting this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Cardamone. Mr. Carroll, are you an attorney in good standing in the State of Illinois?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
You were admitted pro hoc vice to make your argument here today.
Right. I am Martin Carroll. I represent the appellee, Raul Walters. Let me begin by noting that there are two issues that were briefed by National in this appeal. Number one, whether the default period began to run upon mailing or upon receipt of the notice. And two, if the default is cured upon mailing or receipt of its rent payment. I believe that the Court need not reach either issue in this appeal, and that is because it is undisputed that National failed to provide Walters with its annual sales figures within the 30-day default cure period and never provided it with its monthly sales receipts. Both sets of information were to be provided to Walters within 30 days pursuant to the default notice and are both required to be provided under the lease. Pursuant to the lease, National's failure to produce such information is, quote, a material breach of the lease, close quote, pursuant to paragraph 4.3 of the lease. It is undisputed that National did not provide such information within 30 days of the notice. And there was some discussion from counsel about whether its failure was reasonable or not. I would suggest to this court that there is no evidence in the record regarding whether its failure was reasonable or not, because it did not have any witnesses testify at trial. There is no testimony as to whether it was reasonable or unreasonable, and the trial court never even got a chance to reach that issue because they failed to produce a witness to testify to that fact. These issues that I've just talked about are not even addressed in National's brief, but they constitute separate and independent reasons for upholding the lower court's decision. Now, with respect to the issues that were raised by National, there is no dispute, number one, the default notice was mailed by Walters on September 13, 2002 by certified mail. Number two, the notice was received on the 16th of October by National. Number three, the rent payment was mailed by National on October 15th, 32 days after the notice was mailed to it. Number four, the rent payment was received by Walters on October 17, 2002, which was 34 days after the notice was mailed and 31 days after National received the notice. Both the trial and the appellate court found, and National concedes the fact, that the contract is unambiguous in finding that the default cure period began to run on the date of the mailing of the notice. That's not in dispute in this case. Paragraph 22 of the lease provides, and I quote, "The time of any such notice shall begin to run with the date of mailing of such notice." That's what the parties agreed to in this case. Looking at these facts, it's clear that absent any affirmative defense, the lease was terminated when National failed to cure defaults within 30 days of September 13th.
Counsel, if I may, with regard to the cure of the multiple defaults, which is the way that you started your argument, you note in your brief that that argument about the failure to cure the multiple defaults was not a basis of either the trial court or the court of appeals opinion. With regard to the trial court, was testimony presented on that issue?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. In fact, we cited in our brief a cite, I think that was raised in the earlier argument, about whether National had ever submitted its monthly sales figures. And at the site that...
Record 2815, is that what you're talking about?
There's testimony from Len Sircone, who was the property manager for Walter's property, and he testifies that they never received the monthly sales figures.
Opposing counsel, with regard to this multiple default argument, indicates that there would be other evidence to put on with regard to that. At least that's what I heard him say. What's your response to that? In other words, I heard him say essentially that that issue was not developed in the lower court and that they would have further things to put on, that what was addressed in the lower court as well as the Court of Appeals is when does the time start running and when does the time stop running?
Well, I would say that the time is too late for them to raise that argument, Your Honor. There's no question that these defaults were raised in the notice that was sent to them. There's also no question that it was in the complaint that was filed against them. There was testimony at trial as to that issue. They failed to present any witnesses to rebut that testimony.
I understood the argument of your opposing counsel, at least in part, the response to this multiple default argument was a response with regard to the words of the notice. And we get back to the issue of, you know, what trumps here. And they argued, and looking at the paragraphs of the notice, the last two paragraphs, the second to the last paragraph begins, "You are further notified that unless such defaults are resolved, etc., landlord will exercise its remedies under the lease." And, of course, I've left out some parts of that paragraph because they're not relevant for my question. The next paragraph is the focus of my question. "Only full payment of the rent demanded in this notice will waive the landlord's right to terminate possession under this notice," etc. Their argument is, okay, you've set out in the notice the several bases of default, but then in your last paragraph you say, okay, having said all that, if you make full payment of the rent demanded in this notice, it will waive the landlord's right to terminate possession under the notice. And so they argue, I guess, ambiguity or maybe clarity with regard to that final paragraph, and that all that need be done, only full payment of the rent will waive the landlord's right to terminate. So that's what their one of their arguments is. How do you respond to this wording, particularly the last paragraph of that notice and its ability to hold sway over the lease?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it does not abrogate in any way the non-monetary defaults that are noticed in this notice. Those are still required to be resolved by the tenant pursuant to the notice. I think the fair reading of that last paragraph merely states that the landlord's not going to accept a partial payment of the outstanding rent amount that's owed, that they expect full payment. Because if you look at the second clause in that sentence, it says that unless landlord agrees in writing to continue possession in exchange for receiving partial payment, the only thing that's being communicated to the tenant there is that you can't pay us some of the amount within 30 days. You must pay us all of the amount within 30 days unless we agree to it in writing.
If they pay all of the amount in 30 days of the notice, then will the landlord's right to terminate possession be waived?
No, because they still have to cure the non-monetary defaults.
I knew what your answer was going to be, obviously. But that's the focus of their inquiry, and you read it as being plain language, and they either read it as plain language, meaning full payment will take care of it, or ambiguous, I guess. By the way, I assume that the lease was just a standard lease drafted by your client or utilized and presented by your client. Is that correct?
It's actually not clear from the record, Your Honor. However, I do know that this was a negotiated lease. If you page through the lease exhibit, there are many strikeouts throughout. That's obviously an indication that counsel for the tenant negotiated this contract, which is typical in a commercial lease situation, both sides being represented by counsel.
Mr. Carroll, if I can follow up Justice Bradley's question. As I understand your answer, tenant still has to cure the defaults, but for the landlord to terminate possession once full payment is done, they'd have to send a separate notice, would they not?
They would not, Your Honor.
But maybe I'm missing something. Only full payment of the rent demanded in this notice will waive the landlord's right to terminate possession under this notice. Doesn't mean that the defaults are waived. You still have a right to go after the defaults, but it seems to terminate under this notice. Am I missing something?
You're asking if there is, was there a...
In other words, if they made full payment within 30 days, depending upon how we construe the service, if they made full payment within 30 days, but still haven't taken care of the other defaults, they still have to do that, but if you want to terminate possession, you would have to start the process again, would you not?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that this notice gave them 30 days to cure both the monetary and non-monetary defaults.
But it also gave them a way out. The landlord's right to terminate possession under this notice. is full payment.
Well, now, again, I read that last paragraph differently. I read the last paragraph to say, again, that they can't make a partial payment. That last paragraph only deals with the monetary defaults, period, not with the non-monetary defaults. So there is nothing in the lease and nothing in the statutes that I'm aware of that would require the landlord to set yet another notice to them if they paid the rent. The tenant knows full well, both by the notice and by the terms of the lease, what they have to do with respect to the non-monetary defaults. I don't think that it was incumbent upon the landlord to take any other steps once they had sent this 30-day notice to the tenant. And again, there's no evidence in the record that the tenant was unable to comply with the non-monetary defaults within the 30-day period. There's not been a finding of reasonableness, and there's been no testimony to that effect. So it is our reading that they materially breached the lease and this notice when they failed to cure the non-monetary defaults within the time period, as well as their failure to pay the rent amount during the time period.
Mr. Carroll, Justice Butler's reading of that last paragraph just unreasonable?
No, I wouldn't say it's unreasonable, Justice Prosser. I think that the full reading of it, when you look at the second clause, and I think that if you stop reading at the comma, that might have a different meaning. Mm-hmm. But when you add that second clause to it, I think it modifies that first clause of that sentence. Because if you read it any other way, it really reads out that second part of the sentence that talks about we're not going to accept partial payment. So I don't think that the tenant could claim that it was misled by that paragraph. And again, this court will never know that because there's nothing in the record because they didn't testify to that. There is nothing in the record that they relied on anything in this notice. And this has come up later in my argument. There's nothing for the court that said they even relied on this. We don't know that.
I'm a little unclear what it is that we as a court are supposed to pin our decision on. Is it the lease or is it this notice?
We would submit it to the lease, Your Honor, that it is the contract that was entered in between these two entities.
Okay, so if it was the notice that listed all these extra conditions, though, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. So lease conditions.
But you don't always invoke those lease conditions without some kind of a notice.
But let me rephrase my answer. Certainly with respect to when the notice period began to run, we looked to the lease. The notice is obviously important in this case because we're required under the lease to give notice. So without the notice, we could not properly evict the tenant. So clearly the notice has effect, but it does not have the effect that the tenant urges in this case.
Oh, now, Justice Wilcox asked your opposing counsel the question, suppose the notice had said 60 days instead of 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
What would control then?
Your Honor, I would say that would be a very different situation than we have here today for one reason, which is what I started to hear from that discussion sounded more like an estoppel theory to me, that the tenant would have detrimentally relied upon a notice from the landlord that gave them a lot more time than the lease provided for. However, the tenant has not made an estoppel argument in this case, not at the trial level and not in its briefs. That issue is waived in this case. If you're going to have an estoppel claim, first of all, parties are precluded from raising an issue at oral argument that was not presented in its appeal brief. That's not before this court. Also, just looking at equitable estoppel, it looks to the action on the part of one against whom estoppel is asserted, which induces reasonable reliance thereof by the other to his detriment. Now, in this case, there's no evidence that National ever relied upon the word service in the notice because no one from National testified at trial. Also, the court never made a determination whether that reliance, if they had reliance, would have been reasonable in light of the ambiguity of the word service in the notice versus the plain language in the lease found in paragraph 22, which talks about that notice equals mailing.
Well, let me ask this Under 704.17.3, it says, in case of failure to pay rent, all rent due must be paid on or before the date specified in the notice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? 5 says, if you have a contrary provision in the lease, that's valid if the lease is over a year and this is. But you don't have any contrary provision in the lease saying where there is a dispute between the notice and the lease governs.
That's correct.
The statute says that the notice governs. The lease does not have a provision saying, regardless of what we say in the notice, it's 30 days from whatever. So why can't we just say, in this case, 704.17.3 governs?
Your Honor, that statute, the comments to the statute state that in a long-term lease, where both parties are usually represented by counsel in drafting the lease, subsection 5 permits parties to negate the statutory provisions.
I agree with that.
By express agreement.
Right.
In this particular case, the parties agreed that in paragraph 22 of the lease, they agreed specifically that the notice period begins to run upon mailing. So that's the date that that's the provision that we need to look to in this case. The parties both agreed independently. They could have agreed, certainly when they drafted this lease, to follow the statute and say that it's 30 days from the time that you receive the notice. They specifically agreed to change that. They changed it to say, no, it starts to run when the landlord mails the default notice. So I think it takes it outside of the statute under and subsection 5 controls, which says you have to look to the lease in this case. Returning to
your position is the lease governs the notice, right?
That is correct.
Parties agreed on the lease. They put it in writing. It governs. You had to give notice under the lease. Your notice is defective. Notice is defective because it doesn't file the lease. So maybe this whole thing should be thrown out on the grounds that you didn't give appropriate notice.
Well, I'm not sure why it would not be appropriate notice in this case.
Because it doesn't file the lease. And that was the deal.
Well,
you're going to file the lease. So now you give notice that isn't following the lease, and yet you say, oh, well, what difference does that make?
Well,
lease governs.
Remember something. That's only true if you adopt the tenant's interpretation of what service means in the notice.
The notice does not follow the lease term. The lease says nothing about service. You've changed the lease.
That's true. Service is not used in the lease, but I don't think it materially changes the lease provisions at all. The only defense that the tenant has raised in this case, and I think it's important to focus on this, is waiver. That is the only defense here.
But that is the same thing as saying that you changed the lease by giving a notice.
Right.
It was done unilaterally. They're not objecting. You ought to abide by what you agreed to.
Well, I first of all, I would say that I don't think it has that meaning in this case. I don't think service changes the terms of the lease, especially when you – first of all, service isn't defined anywhere. So it's a matter of interpretation of what that means. And I think that, again, look at their defense in this case. Whether or not waiver occurred is a factual determination which requires the proponent prove that the alleged waiving party, in this case Walters, intentionally relinquished a known right. The waiver doctrine focuses on the intent of the party against whom waiver is asserted. Whether waiver occurred is an issue of fact. And this court in Thompson versus Village of Hales Corner, 115 West 2nd 289, held ordinarily questions of waiver are questions of fact for the jury.
Let me just ask you a question. Was this a small claims procedure? We're all the way up here on a small claims procedure, aren't we? We have evictions maybe 15 or 20 a day in small claims, right? Usually not represented by counsel. Was Were the companies represented by counsel here or a co-firm?
They were, Your Honor. They were.
Counsel, are you finished answering that question? No. I don't want to interrupt you.
No, I just wanted to go through the standard review because I think it's very important in this case, because it is our position that the only way that this court can overturn the trial court's decision is if it committed a clearly erroneous decision as to the facts in this case. I don't think it meets that standard by any means. This court in Davies versus J.D. Wilson, 1 Wiss 2nd 443, said the question of waiver is one for a fact for the jury, whereas a matter of inference. If established facts permit reasonable minds to differ as to the inferences it affects from them, a question of fact arises to be determined by the court or jury. The existence of intention to waive the right is generally a question of fact. This court further held in Lucas versus American Mutual Insurance Company of Boston, 81 Wiss 2nd 183, intention is a subjective state of mind to be determined upon all the facts, including the declarations of the person inquired about. Now, here's what's interesting in this case. Only one witness was called at trial, the asset manager for Walters, who testified that he believed notice took effect the day the notice was mailed. He did not testify that Walters intentionally gave National additional time to cure beyond the contractual terms. Just the opposite. His testimony was, no, he was giving them exactly what the lease provided, and no more. Nor would it make any sense in this case, as is clear by the record, to give National more time. The record shows that the tenant was habitually late in its rent payments. It had bounced checks to the landlord. It had failed to pay its real estate taxes. And it had already been sued in the same year by Walters for failure to pay rent, which was later settled. There's absolutely no evidence Walters intended to waive its contractual rights in this case.
Counsel, if the notice had mistakenly, not intentionally, mistakenly said payment of $2,000 will be sufficient to put you in good standing. You know, it's a phrase, it was a bad day, and that phrase got in there from another document. And so then the opposing party paid that and thought everything was fine. What's the results of that?
If the notice had the wrong amount,
yeah.
I would say that if the tenant paid that amount,
mm-hmm.
then the landlord would have to send a new notice for the remaining amount.
Why is that different from, so essentially you're saying they relied on it because they, there wasn't maybe testimony that they relied on it. Now I'm making that up, of course, but they sent in the money, which is the inference that they relied on it. Why isn't that the same thing with regard to the phrase in the notice after service of this notice? That is that the time begins upon service of this notice, the second to the last paragraph. I mean, that's when the time period at which they sent in the payment, that it commenced as of service of notice. That's what they relied on. Although there may not be testimony, that's what happened, just like in my hypothetical. They sent in $2,000, although there wasn't testimony on it, because that's what it says.
Well, perhaps they relied upon it. Again, we don't know that because they didn't testify to that fact. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question,
but their actions, there could be an inference from their actions, because that's what they did, that they relied on.
Well, even, and this is part two, but even if that's true, they still didn't get the money to the landlord within that 30-day period. Even if you adopt their date that they have urged this court to adopt, the October 16th date, the day they received the notice, still didn't.
Is this language after service of this notice? What does that mean?
Well,
30 days will, I'm paraphrasing, will begin to run after service of this notice. What is the phrase, right.
Well,
after service of this notice?
And this also dovetails, I think, with the Chief Justice's question. You know, in its brief, National admits the language contained in the notice, and I quote, after service of this notice, closely tracks the language in paragraph 18 of the lease, which is after lessee has been given notice. So 18 and the notice are actually very similar. Again, the closeness of this language undermines the argument that somehow the notice constituted an intentional waiver of the landlord's rights. I think this is especially true given the fact that paragraph 22 specifically provides that when the notice period begins.
Okay. I mean, I know, and your opposing counsel says paragraph 18 talks about date of notice, paragraph 22 talks about date of mailing. His argument is this notice talks about after service of this notice. But I just want to know, without, and maybe that's not fair if it is, tell me. I want to know how this should be interpreted, but set aside the lease, the language. I want to know, is this plain language? Is it clear? Or is it ambiguous after service of this notice?
Well, I think it's ambiguous, Your Honor. I think that the court, the trial court, and the appellate court had to look at that language and compare it to the lease language. And I think that in this particular case, and as this Court is undoubtedly aware, if there's a conflict between a general and a specific contract provision, the latter controls. In this particular case, the notice language, service, very closely tracks paragraph 18, which basically says the same thing. However, paragraph 18, and I would submit the notice, is governed by the specific provision, which is paragraph 22, which expressly states when the notice period begins.
Well, paragraph 18 says lessee has 30 days after the date of such notice.
Correct.
Okay. Now, I interpret that to mean, you know, this notice is dated, well, it is here, it's dated September 13th, 2002. So if it were dated September 12th, 2002, that's what the date of the notice is. And I look at paragraph 22, and the starting point there is the time that such notice was mailed. Now, I don't know, if you're in my house, you could have something dated on the 13th, but I wouldn't get around to mailing it until the 14th or 15th, you know. Sorry, but that sometimes happens. So, if I were the plaintiff here, what would control if I dated something the 13th, but I didn't mail it until the 15th? What provision controls? Paragraph 18, which says the date of the notice, or paragraph 22, which says the date of the mailing?
Well, I think it would be paragraph 22, Your Honor. Paragraph 22 is a more specific provision that says all notice periods begin on the date of mailing. So whether the landlord would date it September 1st, and not mail it until September 13th is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. The date that's important is the date that they actually mail the notice to the tenant. And in this case, it is undisputed that they mailed it to the tenant on October 13th.
But it sounds to me like paragraph 18 is pretty specific, too. Lessee has 30 days after the date of such notice to correct default. So if you want to know how much time you have to correct default, that seems to be that's pretty darn specific.
Well, I would submit that paragraph 22 is even more specific than that because it specifically goes to when the notice period begins, and that's what the parties agreed to. I think that, going back to the standard review, because I think this is very important.
Mr. Carroll, yes. Before you get to that point, let me ask you something else that's troubling me. Justice Bradley mentioned that this is a notice from 2002. Mr. Burke told us that the lease was renewed in 2003. Is this whole matter moot? What are we here for?
It's absolutely not moot, Your Honor. The tenant did send a notice saying that they were renewing their option. However, they're not allowed to renew their option for 10 years if they're in default. So depending what this court rules, if it rules in our favor, that option exercised by the tenant is a nullity, and they will be evicted.
So what's really going on here, I mean, if I understand what you're – I was wondering what was behind this case, is that whether we construe this as 31 days or 34 days under your position, it's outside the 30, and what's really going on here is you just want to get rid of this tenant because you don't want it for another 10 years.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor.
Got it. All right.
Issues of fact decided by the bench trial must be clearly erroneous in order to be overturned according to Wisconsin Statute 805.172. The facts in this record simply do not support a ruling that the trial court's decision was clearly erroneous. Again, as I mentioned, the only evidence in the record relied upon by National in support of its waiver defense, which is the only defense before this Court, is the text of the default notice. There is no trial testimony by any witness admitting Walters intended to waive its contractual rights, nor any other documents lending support to a waiver theory. I see my time is up. I didn't get to part two, but I'm unless you have any more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Book.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Burke, before you begin, I have a question. We were talking about, I think Justice Bradley has some questions for Mr. Carroll, about the dates in the lease, paragraph 18, the date of the notice, paragraph 22, the date of the mailing. And as I understand your position, you're construing those dates as being date of receipt of notice or receipt of mailing. Now, that's not exactly what it says in paragraph 18 and paragraph 22, is it?
No, Your Honor. In fact, we don't, the appellant doesn't contend that they couldn't have attempted to say the date of the notice, the date of the notice controls. Appellant just says they didn't say that. And in the summary procedure where typically there is no discovery, there is no jury, there is a court commissioner, there is a judge, there typically is one witness, often two witnesses in my experience. The person comes in, there isn't going to be testimony about waiver or much of anything else. It's the judge or the commissioner will look at the notice and say, does the notice comply with, or often the clerk will ask, do you have your 5-day notice with you, that type of thing. The clerk will look at the notice in Milwaukee County, and if it apparently complies with the statute, the writ of restitution will simply issue. If there's a question, there'll be some further discussion, which typically involves the swearing in of one or two witnesses. And what happened, and so the notice will be looked at. The question is, does the notice comply with the lease, or at least the minimum requirements of the lease? And this notice appears to, in the sense that the appellant contends, it gives slightly more time than what the landlord may have intended.
And I'm asking you how you get there if the notice doesn't, if the lease doesn't, the notice or the lease don't refer, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, Your Honor, the lease just says, or rather the notice just says service of the notice. Service of the notice, the Occam's razor, the plain meaning of that is the date you received it. You look at, there's really no further time to get, there's really nothing more to go to. I think most judges, most commissioners would look at that and say, okay, you've got 30 days from the service. The landlord will say, let's look at the lease.
But you have an agreement in the lease as to what that means, right?
Well, in the lease, it means two different things. It means either the date of the notice or the date of the mailing, and the landlord says, in this particular case, Your Honor, those happen to be the same, so that subtle inconsistency in the lease doesn't count. No harm, no foul, that type of thing is essential.
So your position is because they could be different dates, there's an ambiguity, and you want to go by the date on the notice, which is service, and you interpret service to be the date of receipt.
No, I don't think that the appellant's position has to get to that point. The appellant's position is the appellant is presented with the notice. The appellant looks at the note, the tenant looks at the notice that someone else generated unilaterally, and the appellant either, and the tenant either complies or doesn't comply with that notice. If that notice meets the minimum requirements of the statute or the lease, then that should be the end of the matter, and the eviction action should be dismissed. That's our position. If there's further ambiguity, then perhaps you have to resort to the lease, but only to see if the notice is at least minimally complies with the terms of the lease.
Well, let me ask one last question, because this has been bothering me. Assuming we accept your proposal that the 30 days runs upon the receipt of the notice, September 16th, as I understand the NPL's position, the receipt was October 17th, which is 31 days. You're still outside the time.
Well, then that gets to the issue that was also not developed in the trial court at all, because the trial court, and then, of course, the Court of Appeals, simply seized upon the fact that the 13th was the day. If the 16th was the day, then the subsidiary question comes in, well, were you complying by mailing? Again, by mailing the rent in to, I believe, the Columbia, Missouri or somewhere in Missouri. And so the question comes in, okay, well, over that period of time, this is the lease says that they can designate in writing where the rent is to be sent. Again, there's no evidence in the record that this was ever done, nor would you expect that there'd be this kind of evidence in a small claims trial as to the to this type of documentation. This is what was done. And they have a waiver provision in their lease that says, okay, we have that provision about where you send it. They have a waiver provision. And they could have said in the notice, hey, guys, you've been sending this rent by mail, and this has been the accepted practice now for nearly 10 years, but this time we want it received in our office on or before such and such a date, 30 days from the date of the notice. They simply didn't do that.
But do you see anything at all inconsistent about the fact that you're arguing that your date should run from the receipt of the notice, but your mailing runs from the date of mailing the notice?
The answer to that is, on the face of it, yes, but if you look at the real-life realities, no, we're not trying to, in effect, have our cake and eat it, too. They control the notice, and the custom, what apparently was the custom, controls the method and manner of payment. And so the question on any notice that I think a judge will look at in a summary proceeding is, did the landlord get the response? Did the landlord get the performance he could have reasonably accepted under the terms of the default notice? And in this particular case, the tenant respectfully submits that the landlord got what he asked for under the terms of the notice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke, and thank you, Mr. Carroll, for your argument on eviction. And then closes the hearing on 03-08-62, Raul V. J. Walters versus National Properties, LLC. The court will take a brief recess so these students may leave and others may come in. We are in recess.